Turn to Matthew chapter 6. I apologize, I don't have a Mother's Day message this morning. I decided that I should continue with the Sermon on the Mount. There was a church that had a member by the name of Bob. He was an elderly, this is an actual story. He was an elderly, quiet man. He served on no committees. He regularly attended church. Nobody ever heard him complain. He was the kind of person that was just sort of easily overlooked. And then finally, he got cancer and pneumonia and died. Not too long after that, somebody noticed that the light that illuminated the sign for their church was out. So they went to the trustee, one of the trustees, and asked him to check on that and repair it. And it occurred to him that that had never happened. It never happened. He didn't even know where the key was to the case that held the sign. And then not too long after that, the clock in the church stopped. And they discovered that the battery was dead. And then it occurred to them that that had never happened in anybody's memory. And then the hinge on one of the cabinet doors broke. And it was weeks and nobody did anything about it. And finally somebody fixed it, and then they realized that those kinds of things hadn't happened. This is something new. And after a number of incidents like that, they realized that this man had taken personal responsibility for all the things, all the practical things that that church needed. Never told anybody. People weren't aware that he was doing that. He did his service in secret. Well, his service to the church was real because he was practicing exactly what Jesus teaches in this passage. And this morning, I would like to speak on the subject of real righteousness. Now, this first part of this passage is on almsgiving, and you might say, well, why don't we talk about almsgiving? Well, they tell me, and I wanted to talk to Leonard, and I'll talk to him after the service. I'm not sure this is a Hebrew term. It's the term, if I can lay my eyes on it here. They had the same term for righteousness as they had for almsgiving. It was T-Z-E-D-A-K-A-H. Is that a Hebrew term? It is. Well, they say they use both of those terms. For alms, I mean, that they used that term for both righteousness and almsgiving. It was the same word used for both. Now, Matthew 6 takes us now to the piety behind the morality that we discussed in chapter 5. Chapter 5 is about the kingdom morality, how people live in the kingdom of God in very practical areas. And now we go into chapter 6. And this is going to be the inner life. This is going to be the piety that gives the outward expression that people see its genuine dynamic. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is that right here at the beginning of this passage, we're going to be talking about a piety that can be corrupted by self. Well, wait a minute. We go back to the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and that's the very first thing that happened when we came into the kingdom. We put self on the cross. And here it has come back in its religious form. In chapter 5, we have the grosser forms of selfishness, lust, anger, hatred, retaliation, dishonesty. That's to be expected. I mean, that's sinful stuff. That's selfish stuff. But here we come into chapter 6, and self creeps right back in again in the form of religion. After putting grosser forms of self on the cross, the old self comes back in the form of religion. So we want to talk about real righteousness this morning, and I'll give you my outline. The first thing that we find in this passage is what I call ridiculous righteousness. And that's chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. And then we have, which is taking the title of my message, Real Righteousness. And that's chapter 6, verses 3 and 4a. And then we're going to have Rewarded Righteousness. And that's 6, 4b. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning. Now, to the Jew, there were three cardinal things in one's relationship with God. It was almsgiving. And it's interesting how this sort of covers all of life. Almsgiving is piety in relation to others. Next time we'll talk about prayer, which is piety in relation to God. And then finally fasting, which is piety in relation to ourselves. And someone has suggested that to really make these work the way they should be practiced in reverse order. Fasting to deal with our own problems, prayer to cultivate a relationship with God, and then almsgiving in how we reach out to other people. But the interesting thing about the Jewish faith was they put the most emphasis on almsgiving. We already noticed that they used the same term for righteousness as they used for almsgiving. Those two, they did not really separate very much. In fact, it's very interesting what they have to say about this in the apocryphal literature. In Tobit 12:8, it says this, and listen carefully to this. It is better to give alms than to lay up gold. Almsgiving doth deliver from death and purges away all sin. Wow. I would not have said that giving alms helps somehow with the resolution of your guilt and sin. That's what it's saying. Ecclesiasticus 3:14 and 15 says, almsgiving to a father shall not be blotted out. And as a substitute for sins, it shall stand firmly planted. In the day of affliction, it shall be remembered to thy credit. It shall obliterate thine iniquities as the heat doth the hoarfrost. I was rather shocked when I read that, that the Jewish people would have held such a view of almsgiving that it basically atones for your sin. Is that going too far? Well, what came to my mind, I'm going to explain. Yeah, I think that is perhaps stating it in a way I wouldn't want to state it. But what came to my mind was Zacchaeus. Jesus was at his house, and he finally said, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and I'm going to make restitution with my wealth. And Jesus said, today salvation has come to this house. In Jesus' evaluation, his almsgiving, what he did with his stuff, his generosity, basically was his salvation. Or at least was an indication of his salvation, let's say it that way. And then my mind went to Matthew 25. The final judgment, based on feeding the hungry, clothing the naked. Not a word said about the things we usually talk about. I think what's happening here is the almsgiving itself as an act is not what saves. But genuine almsgiving is a true sign of salvation wrought in the heart. If a person can bring himself to genuinely, we're going to talk about the genuine and the false. If a person can respond to God and the Holy Spirit and the regeneration that God wants to work in his heart and brings him to a genuine expression of this particular virtue, that's tied up somehow with the salvation that's happening in his life. Jesus describes the key to genuine almsgiving. He did not dispute the three pillars of righteousness which the Jewish people had laid out, which I said was alms, prayer, and fasting. These do cover all of life. They are the true sacraments of the church. Now, I sometimes think in our reaction to Roman Catholicism and its sacraments and its means of grace, which they say is penance, pilgrimages, the wafer, extreme unction, all of those things they say help you to get grace. We disagree with that. That's wrong. I think sometimes we've gone to the other extreme and we don't realize that there are true means of grace. And here we have them. Because at the end of every one of them, it says the Lord will reward you. You will receive something from God if you can truly practice these three things. So, but Jesus insists that it must be a real righteousness. It must be a righteousness that exceeds. So let's first of all talk about ridiculous righteousness. The phrase to be seen is the word from which we get the word theater. Okay? It's the word from which we get the word theater. It's a whole, if you look in Strong's Concordance, there's a family of those words. And they all have the word that we get the word theater from. It means to parade our righteousness. That's literally what it means. Self dies hard. It will make all kinds of compromises. It will parade itself in all kinds of forms, but it does not want to die. This is the temptation with all public religious activities. I don't know about you, but I really have to struggle with public prayer, or I find myself praying to the audience. I really have to struggle to make sure that I don't have as much trouble with this one because I really do get involved in singing my song to the Lord. But I think some people they struggle in this area. When they're singing, they're very conscious of the impression they're making while they're singing. Preaching. If we're not careful, we're very conscious of how people are, whether they like what we're preaching. Whether it gains us some recognition, and what people are going to talk about it after, what they're going to say. And if we're not careful, we drop little hints to see what people are thinking. So, humility often puts on a subtle parade. It's hard to do any of these public things to God alone. I don't know, I should talk to some other people, but I'm going to be honest with you. It's very difficult, and I'm conscious of this. In fact, I was in a meeting recently, and I was really struggling because I sensed that I was concerned about the impression I was making by the way I was responding in that meeting. I'm being honest with you. The story is told, and I think I told this story here before, but I enjoy hearing stories over again, especially if I know how they end. A pastor was resigning in a little church and going to a bigger church, and so he preached his last sermon. Then he went to the back of the church and everybody was coming and saying how bad they would miss him. Some people were crying and, you know, this all, of course, made him feel very good. And then there were two elderly ladies. They were the last ones. And they were really crying. I mean, they were just crying their eyes out. And so he said to them, he said, don't feel so sad. I'm sure the next pastor will be even better. And they said, but that's the problem. That's what they always say, but they keep getting worse and worse. You see what he was doing? He was trying to be real humble. I'm sure the next one will be better. But he was expecting them to say, no, we're going to miss you. And they didn't say that. Okay? We avoid the most obvious things that other people do. We don't put nameplates on the edge of our pews to say who gave that each pew. People put nameplates on hospital doors to say that they paid for that room. They put names on stained glass windows. I'm always amazed that this stuff happens because don't people read this? Well, we don't do that. I mean, we do know enough not to do the really gross, obvious things that call people's attention to what we're doing. But what do we do when no one is looking? The person who prays the flowery prayer. It'd be interesting to know, and maybe you'd be blessed, how much time he spends in private praying. That'd be interesting to know. It's something I have to think about in relation to myself, in relation to public prayer. How much secret prayer is it? Well, the reward shows us that God is fair. He does not withhold the reward that we wanted. He says, paid in full. You wanted the approval of people. You wanted people to notice, and they did. You're paid. Here's the receipt. I owe you nothing more. All right? But we find that we have exchanged it for the reward He really wanted to give us. And we're going to talk about that later. Now, what are some things that we can do here? I mean, I don't like to say negative things unless I can project something positive. So how can we deal with this problem? Well, the best way to do this is to redirect your focus, of course, from yourself to others. Well, we all know that. That's pretty obvious. But how do you do that? Well, the key was at the end of chapter 5 when we were talking about how we relate to enemies. You cannot probably deal very well with those feelings if you're just going to deal with them in the abstract. Ooh, I want to be more humble. I want to be more generous with other people. I want to be less proud. You probably won't succeed very well. Now, you can pray that God will give you those things, and that'll help. But at the end of chapter 5, he says loving your enemies means doing something. It means praying, doing good, and loving them. And so I suggest that if you're having a problem with self-consciousness about all the good things you're doing, that you start to get involved with people who have real needs. I think of parents, for instance, that know they're going to have a handicapped child, maybe ahead of time, or the child is born and they know the child is handicapped. And they really, I mean, self just, this just spoils everything. And then you talk to them 25 years later. Let's say 25 years later, the child dies. And you find out that in the process of their having to be involved with this child all those years, their sentiments went from themselves to the child, and they really do miss the child because they were involved. So the key, I think, is to involve ourselves with people. Get involved and your focus will shift. Someone at the last CAM open house said, when I hear of a problem somewhere in the world, the first thing I think of is, what can I do to relieve their suffering? Now thinking about, how can I rack up some recognition here by how I respond?
I see.
I did. Just a minute. All right. Samuel Johnson was the author of the first English dictionary. He was a very famous person. But what people don't know about Samuel Johnson is how he related to this particular issue in his life. And I'm going to tell it. I'm just going to read it from his biographer, who was James Boswell. Boswell says this about Johnson. Coming home late one night, he found a poor woman lying on the street, so much exhausted she could not walk. He took her upon his back and carried her to his house, where he discovered that she was one of those wretched females who had fallen into the lowest state of vice, poverty, and disease. Instead of harshly upbraiding her, he had her taken care of with all tenderness for a long time at considerable expense, till she was restored to health and endeavored to put her in a virtuous way of living. All that Johnson got out of this was an unworthy suspicion of his own character. But the heart of the man demanded that he should give to this woman. Surely one of the loveliest pictures in literary history is the picture of Johnson in his own days of poverty, coming home in the small hours of the morning. Now, this is when he was poor himself. And as he walked along, slipping pennies into the hands, and a penny was worth something back then, slipping pennies into the hands of waifs and strays who were sleeping in the doorways because they had nowhere else to go. One of his friends tells us that one asked him how he could bear to have his house filled with the necessitous and undeserving people. And they say his house is full of them. And this also seems to me to have been true of C.S. Lewis. And Johnson answered why he had his house filled with needy people, some of them disreputable people. It didn't help his reputation at all. In fact, if you read what secular people say about him, they say he was sort of a person who didn't care too much about himself. He was sort of sloppy and neglected. I see why. His mind was not on himself. And when asked why he did all this, he said, "If I did not assist them, no one else would. And they must not be lost for want." William Booth one time was not able to attend one of the conventions of the Salvation Army, and he sent his message by telegram. It was one word: others. So I think the real issue here is, you know, it's pretty easy to have pride in what we're doing if it's all sort of done in the abstract. We write out the checks. We give the money here. We do this. We build this. But it's all sort of in the abstract. But if we really would get our hands dirty and our hearts entwined with people in need, I think a relationship would begin to develop with people in need and the needs of themselves. And this would go a long way to get our minds off of ourselves and onto others so that this problem could be resolved. So that's ridiculous righteousness. It's a righteousness that does what it does for the reward that it wants for itself now. Now, the real righteousness doesn't keep count of its giving as a measure of its righteousness. It doesn't look at the things it's done. In fact, the interesting thing to me is in Matthew 25, when the Lord tells what they actually did, they say, "Well, when did we do that?" And I used to wonder why they said that, because it seems to me like they should have known they were doing it. But I think in their mind, the need was so great and what they did was so little in relation to the need that it really didn't count that much in their own thinking. They could have done more. So, Clarence Jordan says this best. I should read this passage. I didn't read it. Let me read it. Chapter 6, verse 1. "Take heed that you do not your alms before men to be seen of them. Otherwise, ye have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. Therefore, when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But when thou doest thine alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth, that thine alms may be in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret himself shall reward thee openly." Now, Clarence Jordan, I think, really did it well. So I'm just going to read again, word for word, what he says about this passage. The phrase "truly secret" is about the equivalent of our expression "from the heart." When one gives grudgingly or for show, his heart is not in the gift. He will reach into his pocket with his right hand, and then with his left hand, he will carefully count out the exact amount he wishes to give. This enables him to keep an accurate account of his righteousness. Every deed is recorded in detail and due pride taken therein. But when one gives in secret or from the heart, he reaches into his pocket with his right hand, and takes out all there is and just puts it in the offering. He doesn't count it. That is, his left hand never enters into the transaction. He isn't interested in figures. He's interested in people. It's just what I said. He wants no record, any more than a mother wants a record of how many times she has warmed the baby's bottle. His is an expression of love, and love never keeps records, for it never thinks in terms of profit or loss. Stingy people always let their left hand know what their right hand is doing. They give till it hurts. And they always know exactly how badly they are hurt. But loving, generous kingdom citizens need but one hand with which to make their gifts. they give until it's gone. Like the Father who sends sunshine and rain upon the good and the bad alike, their dealings with others are based on their own inherent goodness rather than the worthiness or the unworthiness of the objects of their charity. And the Father rewards them by making them even more big-hearted. See, their actions do something to their heart. Just as the reward of selfishness is an increasingly selfish, stingy nature. Billy Graham told the story when he was early in his ministry, when they were rather poor. He went somewhere to give a talk, and then they took up an offering. And he was the only person sitting on the platform. By the way, this is a very unique experience if you have any experience going out and doing public speaking. They brought the basket and handed it to him. And so he pulled out his wallet, and there was only one bill there, and he thought it was a dollar bill. So he took the dollar bill and put it in the basket, and as he put it in the basket, he realized it was a $10 bill, which was more than he had in mind giving. And then they didn't give him any gift or honorarium for speaking. And on the way home, he was pitying himself pretty badly, and so he was saying to his wife, "What happened?" And she said, "Well, Billy, you know that you're only going to get a $1 reward because you only meant to get $1. That is so realistic. I don't know how many of you have read Schindler's List. I haven't read it. There's a film which I have not seen. I simply have read about it. And here's a man who delivered about 1,000 Jews from the death chamber. He was not a Christian, not by any means, as I read the story. But this compassion, the Bible talks about bowels of compassion. I don't know where this man got it. I guess he got it simply by involving himself. I guess this works even for people who aren't Christians. Involving themselves with other people does something to them. And they tell me that at the end of the film, when they talk to him about what he has done, he sits down and he cries. He's just sitting there weeping and saying, "I wish I could have done more. There's my car. I could have sold my car. That would have saved 10 more Jews. There's my," and he pointed to other possessions, "I should have sold that. That would have saved a few more. I should have sold that. That would have saved a few more." He was all wrapped up in the need and the people involved. I'm not there. But I think this preparation for this little message has helped me to make some resolves as to how to get there better than I have. So now we have a ridiculous righteousness. We have a real righteousness that focuses on the need, that focuses on the people, which takes our interests and our feelings and all of those things that go the wrong direction. It starts to redirect them away from ourselves. And this is a short message. My last point is a rewarded righteousness. Now, we say it's wrong to work for rewards. We don't think it's good for Christians to be motivated by rewards. Well, the problem is Jesus didn't think that. He was frequently talking about rewards. Three times in this chapter, he promises a reward. And it says, even a cup of cold water given in the name of Christ will not lose its reward. And so there will be a reward. But not if we were thinking about ourselves. If we truly were involved with the needs of people and we truly gave with a heart of generosity. I want you to turn to a scripture which you know is very precious to me, but I want to put it a little bit in context. Would you turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 9? Verse 6, "But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man, as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver." And we've talked here about the fact that word cheerful is hilarious. A person who puts his whole heart delightfully into what he's doing. But look at the reward. I think many times we take this verse 8, I know in the past I've done it, take this verse 8 out of its context. He's saying, if you are a hilarious giver, you can depend on God to be a hilarious giver. And God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound in every good work, based on the quality of your own giving. There's a reward. Jesus said, if you give the way you're supposed to give, there will be a reward. All right? Luke 6, 35 and 36, when it talks about loving our enemies, he says the reward of that will be, you will be the children of the highest. You will somehow be more intimately involved in the family of God. I want you to turn to Matthew 25. For the two people who did what they should have done with their talents, look what he says to both of them. Verse 21, for the first one. His Lord said unto him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. You invested them the way I wanted you to. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. I have to wonder, you know, the picture most people have of heaven is a rather passive existence, sitting on a cloud somewhere playing a harp or walking golden streets or something. What does he mean? I will make thee ruler over many things. You know, he made man to have dominion. It hasn't worked very well in this sinful world. But what kind of rulership will God give to those who have proven to be faithful in this life? Now, the Mormons believe we're each going to have our own universe. I don't think that's probably the case, but that intrigues me. That intrigues me. The degree of dominion that we will exercise in the future, as I see it, or maybe even in this life, is going to be based on how we served, how we did with the talents God gave us as he wanted us to. All right? I conclude, I said this will be a short message. I think it's enough for us to think about this morning. And the point I want to make the most is this happens when we become involved with people. Probably if we don't become involved with people and our giving is always sort of abstract, you know, we don't actually connect with the people that have the need. And there's a place for that kind of giving, of course. But if that's all we do, we probably are going to really struggle here with an awful lot of failure. I just am amazed. Our family has not done what I see other families doing. I mean, they take in handicapped children. They take in foster children. They take in all kinds of needs into their homes, just like Johnson did. And I think that was the secret of the early church. If you read the early church, you wonder, why did they have such success? It's because they didn't leave anybody behind. If there was a need somewhere, the church was out there taking care of the need. Marcus Aurelius, who was the emperor who tried to return the Roman state to paganism after it had adopted Christianity, he wanted to take it back to paganism, and he tried and he tried and he tried. And his complaint at the end was, the Christians outserved us. They take care of their own, and they take care of ours. That was what he said. Gary Miller, Caldwell, Idaho. A little church that 50% of the members are from the community. And I said to Gary, I said, what is your secret? Care. And yes, when you're there, there's a girl there who cannot move her arms. She's totally handicapped. You walk up to her to say hi, and she cannot shake your hand. There are other handicapped people in that congregation. It's obvious that that congregation has reached out in care to the community around them. I pondered for years the tremendous dynamic success of the Wesley's ministries. And it's only in recent years that I discovered what I think was probably the reason for it. And that was Wesley had this one right. And Luke 16 says, if you've not been faithful in that which is least, who shall commit your trust to true riches? Wesley wrote about 200 books in his lifetime, And the sale of those books, they claim, brought in probably in today's money about $150,000 a year. That's a lot of money today. They say that Wesley took a salary in today's money of $14,000, and the rest was given away. And if you read his journal, I think a lot of that $14,000 was given away too. And he said, if I die with more than 5 pounds to my name, and 5 pounds was a lot of money back then, more money than it is today, he said, you can consider that I was a cheat and a hypocrite. He required all of the people in his Methodist fellowships to contribute a penny a week when they came for the class meetings. He said when a man got converted, did his wallet get converted? That was the most important thing to Wesley, is what people did with their possessions. And it was said of him when he died, that when Wesley died, he left a battered hat, a tattered Bible, and a worn-out coat, and the Methodist Church. I don't think that's a mystery. I think it was based on the fact that for everything that Wesley didn't have right, the infant baptism, the member of the Church of England, I can name a number of things that Wesley did not have right, but he had this one right, and God blessed him. Shall we bow our heads for prayer, and then we'll have a song. Father, I thank you.